This is episode 154 of the Prepper Website Podcast. Today's articles are Tips for Foraging Safely During a Survival Scenario and Tires as Part of Basic Vehicle Preparations. Hey, I'm Todd Sepulveda, the editor of PrepperWebsite.com. This podcast is an audible version with some commentary of articles that have been posted on Prepper Website, a daily curation of preparedness information. These articles are some of the best of the best that have been recently posted on PrepperWebsite.com. All article links and show information can be found on the PrepperWebsitePodcast.com. Hey, before we get started, did receive another review, but it was a two-star review. But it's from Sam Tracy, and he says, I listened to two recent episodes and couldn't get into it. The format is essentially the host reading two articles about prepping aloud and commenting on them. Unfortunately, it's usually preceded by 10 to 15 minutes of fluff without any real content. Just not information dense enough for me. I'm just going to read the articles instead, which will take 5 minutes instead of 45 minutes. And so, Sam, totally agree with you, man. If you are into, you know, getting all the information and wanting to get as much information as you can, go over to PrepperWebsite.com and you have all the information that you possibly want. We post the best preparedness articles of the day there on PrepperWebsite.com. I can only touch the surface of what we do daily over there on the podcast. And so if that's what you're interested in, definitely go over to PrepperWebsite.com. The podcast, though, it's a little bit different. You know, when I started the podcast, I realized I could not do what, you know, there's a lot of great podcasts out there. I cannot do what someone like Jack Spirko does. I cannot do what something like, Dell and Lisa, what they do over at Survivalist Prepper. I can't do what Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy do, in their podcast. I knew that and didn't want to, because there are so many other great podcasts out there, didn't want to wind up doing that, just kind of replicating that. Because after a while, you start talking about the same things over and over again. And I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to provide something very, very different. And so one of the things that I realized is that we are reaching a new audience out there, because there are people that don't come over to PrepperWebsite.com. They don't know what they're looking for. They don't know how to search for preparedness articles. They don't even know that it might be out there. And so they might stumble upon it, you know, by accident or whatever. But being podcasts are very popular, they're on iTunes and Stitcher and some of the other podcast networks, they can easily find us. And so there's new preppers who are coming on board or new people coming on board to preparedness because of the Prepper Website Podcast. And then the other thing is that there's people, I've heard from a lot of people, it's like, hey, I'm very busy. I can't read articles. I can't go to Prepper Website and read the articles all the time. And so I do appreciate the articles being read and then the commentary on top of that. And so I have received that feedback as well. And the other thing is just the preparedness community. There's that aspect of getting to know each other just a little bit. You know, when you read the articles, you might get an idea and a feel for that person. You might get an idea for, where they're coming from. But, I'm trying to build just something a little bit more than just I'm writing articles or putting content out there on Prepper Website. I'm trying to build just going for a preparedness community here, because preparedness, when you think about it, because so many people are, it's very isolating, because there's so many people that think we're kooks and we're crazy and all that kind of stuff out there. And so, having someone maybe you identify with them and, you're hearing their voice on a weekly, on a daily basis, on a weekday basis, able to come over to the Facebook community or to the group and, accepting people over there and people are coming in writing and posting and different things like that and commenting and sharing their ideas and sharing information that they find. I don't want to tolerate people being rude and coming in and attacking other people. We're not going to do that. We're trying to build a place where people can feel comfortable asking questions. And so if you are a new prepper and you have questions, and we recently received that question on the in the Facebook group. So if you are a new prepper and you have questions, you can come over there and not feel like you're going to be, you know, ridiculed by so many people who've been prepping for, you know, all their life and whatever. And you put up a question and it's like, hey, are you stupid? You know, how can you not know this, right? You're new to preparedness. You have no idea. You have no clue. And so there's just so much more than that. But if you're just looking for the articles, yeah, Prepper Website is the place to go. If you are looking for something a little bit more, you're new to preparedness, you can't get to Prepper Website on a regular basis, these articles, I hope the podcast is beneficial. And I know it's beneficial because the podcast is growing. I mean, the subscriber numbers are going up and it is growing. And I feel very, very blessed by everyone who's out there supporting it and the feedback that I get. And so thank you for those of you who do come to the podcast and listen every day, and those of you who do put up the reviews, and especially the 5-star reviews. I really do appreciate those. Those always help with the algorithms. But get that information out there. And so Sam, I hope you find what you're looking for on Prepper Website. We do have a ton of stuff. Hey, this is, afternoon I was on Facebook and just kind of searching around a little bit, you know, wasting a little bit of time, and saw that there was a shooter at a church, and I believe this is in Tennessee. And it's come out that the guy who did it was from Sudan. Now, he came legally into this country. He was here in the 1990s. And so I don't know if this is religious. I mean, hearing that he was from Sudan, immediately my thoughts start going into this is religiously motivated, but it might not be. It might be. I don't know. That hasn't come out yet, at least in the different things that I have found. I haven't been able to see that. But what happened was, he pistol whipped one of the guys that confronted him right off the bat, because this shooter shot somebody in the parking lot, then went into the church and shot up a bunch of people. And so he pistol whipped this guy who confronted him right at the beginning. I guess maybe it was at the entrance of the church. Well, the guy that was pistol whipped went to his car and retrieved his gun. Now, my thing is, he was a concealed handgun license carrier. And so, you know, carry the gun. I know it's kind of weird carrying it in a church. And to be honest with you, when I get up and because this article is very, it's very pertinent to me because I'm a pastor and I really consider that. But you know, if I had people in my congregation who carry, I have no problem with them carrying, you know. And so sometimes it's hard for me to kind of focus on that because I am preaching. I'm in another world when I'm there doing that. But I have no problem with concealed handgun people, you know, coming in. And in Texas, you know, open carry is fine too. And I'm sure plenty of the people in my church, because we're a little bit more preparedness minded there, would have no problem with that as well, having the open carry. But you know, definitely, just because you're in church, you're not in a safe place. You know, unfortunately, I have a feeling that churches might get targeted more and more because there's not enough security. Churches do not have security forces, or they do not have people that are armed a lot of the time. Some of the bigger ones do. Even some of the smaller ones do as well. I mean, we went to a decent-sized church. We visited for a little while, where one of the ushers who stood in the back did carry. And he was always watching people. I always knew it was kind of strange that he was out back there and he was always watching people. But then I found out that, you know, he was carrying. And so, I was like, okay, so he's just watching and he's making sure things are good. But, that's one thing. If you are a Christian, if you are going to, and there are a lot of Christians in the preparedness community, more than you would realize, more than let it be known out there. But if you are in a state that allows you to conceal carry, you know, go for it, man. Because I believe at one point we might see more and more of these. So I'll link to a couple of articles there, but it was all over. It's on the Drudge Report and it was on social media. This NFL thing is absolutely crazy. There's so many people. I mean, people that are burning their flags, people that are flags of their favorite football teams. You know, I've seen a couple of those on social media. I clicked on an article on the Daily Wire that during the national anthem at the Texans and New England Patriots game, so they were up in New England today, that there were people booing. They were booing the New England Patriots for doing that. And so there's a lot of people out there like, hey, free speech and all that kind of stuff. And there's all the things out there. And then Donald Trump and President Trump getting in, you know, involved with it. Part of my conspiracy, you know, my feelers kind of go up there. And I'm just wondering if that is part of distraction. If he, you know, he's not a dumb guy, right? He got to where he was because he does know how to get things done and even manipulate if you have to. And so he knows that this is a hot topic. So he starts floating it out there. So you got the NFL all ticked off, or at least you got the players. Now here's the thing, you've got people that are the people that watch football are going to be your red-blooded Americans, patriotic to the core, apple pie, hamburgers, all that stuff. And then, you know, so it's like they're already feeling it, some of the boycotts and stuff like that. There was a stadium, I saw an article, a stadium that was, you know, really empty. There's a lot of seats. And one of the guys that I saw on Facebook, he's a Ravens season ticket holder. And he was so ticked off, man. He's like, he's done, you know. And so they're isolating a lot of the people that that support them. And so I don't know, man. I don't know where it's going. But again, I start to think, is this kind of distraction to get people talking about NFL and talking about football? And now you got the NBA in it, and now you got a guy in baseball doing it, and getting to talk about all that kind of stuff while other things are going on. So I don't know. Maybe you have your ideas on that as well. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of people that get all, you know, have a lot of strong feelings about it on both sides of it. And you know, people are like, hey, you got the freedom to do express yourself however you want. Other people is like, hey, but yeah, but these people are being paid and it's disrespectful, and you got, you know, all that side. And so I don't think this little topic here is done. The NFL, I don't know if they're going to eventually start caving. If they start losing enough money, they will cave. Although for the time being, they might start blaming it on all kinds of other things. They'll blame it on Harvey and on Maria and all the other kinds of things. And so who knows? But we'll see what happens as this goes. If you have some definite feelings, drop them in the comments of episode 154, and I'll read them this week and, you know, kind of get it out there. I know people have a lot of very, very strong feelings. Hey, talking about Irma and Maria and you know, Harvey and all those, the whatever, you got Irma. It looked like it's turned up north. It jogged west just a little bit, enough to that there's some, you know, going to be some issues with tropical storm warnings and stuff like that on the East Coast, like North Carolina, I believe. And so you have that, but man, the devastation in Puerto Rico and those islands are devastating. I mean, it's devastating. And they're talking about not having power for 4 to 6 months. And you know, you're going to start, if you want to see what would happen in something like that, you might want to start monitoring what's happening over there in those islands, because that might be a small microcosm of what would happen if something like that happened here in the United States. Now, you know, we're not wanting bad things to happen. Definitely, please, we pray for those people. And, you know, Harvey in the Gulf Coast and all the fire. We prayed specifically this, you know, at church for everybody that's affected. But, and we continue to pray for them. I mean, that there, people are going to lose their life just because they don't have electricity. That's going to happen. But, you know, we need to stay abreast of what's going on over there and paying attention, because, you know, and there might be some lessons learned, some positive lessons learned. But, and hopefully don't, you know, people, I think, poured out a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of energy into Harvey and what was going down here on the Gulf Coast. And then a little bit into Florida, you know, but, you know, it's easy to start getting overwhelmed with it all. And it's kind of like, hey, I've given here, I've given here, I've given here. And so, you know, we can do whatever we can and support the people that are over there on those islands. Again, it's going to be devastating. All right, so for Sam and all the other people that are upset, I went a long time there, 14 minutes. So getting into it, but hopefully there are some interesting things that I shared there with you, and hopefully it is encouraging in a way. So our first article comes to us from PreppersWill.com, and it's tips for foraging safely during a survival scenario. I think this is important. I think this is, and it's hard. It is hard to learn how to forage because you're having to learn all about the different things that are out there in the different plants and you know what plant what you know, you can eat the leaves here, you can eat the roots here, and I like some of the suggestions here. So we'll move forward with this article here. Tips for foraging safely during a survival scenario. In a survival situation, food may not be your priority. However, as the crisis prolongs, food will become an important item on your survival list. You should not let yourself starve when there are all sorts of wild plants you could live on. Follow these tips for a successful foraging experience. When the brown stuff hits the fan, many of your neighbors will rely on hunting or fishing to secure their meals. If you don't have the right skills to fish or hunt, you can still make it out alive. Since the dawn of time, humans managed to survive with what nature had to offer. You may not have the skills for catching animals and be a good hunter, but you can still be a successful gatherer. When you have to source for your food, you will have to do some foraging if you lack the knowledge of hunting or fishing. Scouting for food in the wild may seem easy at first, but foraging is more than walking around in the woods and spotting delicious berries. Some plants may be easily recognizable, while others can easily be confused with their edible counterparts. The big disadvantage of foraging is that you can get poisoned if you don't pay attention to what you're picking or when you're trying out new foods. Foraging requires a good knowledge of the environment and a little bit of practice in the wild. Even so, there are some helpful tips which can help anyone while foraging. Stick with what you know. An experienced forager will be able to explore and discover new foods in his or her environment. However, you should stick with familiar food and keep your foraging to the food you're familiar with. This statement may sound like common sense to you, but a lot of people tend to ignore it. While it may be true that a lot of plants in your area may be edible, there are also many poisonous foods you are unaware of. Sticking to what you know may restrict your options for procuring food, but it will also reduce your chances of getting poisoned. You don't want to deal with a case of poisoning when you are wandering in the wild. Go easy with unfamiliar plants. Since most people are incapable of sticking to the above rule, they shouldn't go overboard either. If you must go beyond the range of plants you're familiar with, then you have to take some precautionary measures. Start by taking just a small portion to see how it affects your body. After 24 hours, you can make it part of your everyday meal if it didn't cause you any adverse reactions. The last part of this article covers some suggestions on how to identify edible plants and test them. Eat only what you can and don't go the extra mile. The Boy Scouts have a saying that goes like this: eat only what a bear can eat, and it's applicable for every foraging trip you make. To put it in a few words, if a bear can't eat a meal, then it's probably not good for your body. This rule can help you avoid poisoning and keeps you target on familiar fruits and berries. However, foraging is also about conserving energy and working smart. It's not worth it to go after pinecone seeds or dig for roots if the job takes a lot of time and you end up spending a lot of energy. Stick to easier foraging tasks and plants you can easily identify. Do not harvest everything and leave some for later. When you are hungry and you manage to find some foods that are nutritious, there is something that takes over you. Most people have a hard time controlling themselves and they harvest all food at once. Rather than depleting your food source in one go and damaging the plants, learn to harvest the food bit by bit. By doing so, you will make sure it will last longer, and you have a backup plan if the crisis prolongs. Even more, you can take it one step further and plant the seeds or stems of the food in the vicinity of your campsite. You will be able to produce more food if you have to stay in an unfamiliar environment for a long time. Don't start foraging at night. Even experienced campers or survivalists get injured at night, and they avoid going out after sundown. You should do the smart thing and avoid going out to find food if you are stranded in an unfamiliar environment. You may encounter a wild animal or get lost on the way back to camp. Even a small injury can leave you incapacitated for a long time when you lack proper medical care. I stick to daytime foraging when I go to the woods, and I advise you do the same. Pay attention to the competition. You're not the only living thing that's foraging for food out there. While this may not seem obvious at first, the delicious berries you're feasting on can also attract other animals. The last thing you want to happen is being devoured by a bear or picking a few berries. While this scenario may be an extreme one, you should know that even smaller animals can become a problem for your safety. A crazed raccoon can do a lot of damage if you corner it, while a snake bite can seal your fate. Many people are clueless about wilderness navigation, and they grab everything in sight before looking at the thing they are reaching for. Use caution and don't shake the shrub like it's the end of the world. The berries are not going anywhere. Hey, I would say this, though. Like, for instance, up in the country, we do have blackberries that grow wild. And, there was a weekend where my brother and my dad went up there, and they found them. I mean, we hadn't noticed them in the past. And they found them, and they're like, oh, hey, this is great. And they went back about 2 or 3 weeks later, and they were just completely gone. And the deer had just eaten them all up. And so, you know, you always have that you're competing with, as well as if you're in an environment where there's bears. I mean, you're going to be dealing with that too. All right, so tips on how to identify edible plants during foraging. When it comes to identifying plants which are safe to eat, there are mainly two tests you can do. Even so, you shouldn't do this unless you're absolutely desperate and there's no other way around it. These two quick tests can be done by anyone and can help you identify edible food from poisonous food. However, as I said before, you should avoid doing this if you have other ways of procuring food. The skin contact test. This one is pretty simple, and it is done by placing some parts of the seed or leaf on your skin. You should leave it there for a few minutes and check for adverse reactions. If the spot starts feeling itchy or you feel a burning sensation, then it means that the plant is very poisonous. Usually 3 minutes should be enough to carry out this test. If you notice any reaction to the plant, leave it be and check out for other plants in the area. The mouth test. This is a riskier one, but is much more proficient than the first one. Many people got poisoned after trying this, either because they didn't follow the rules or they picked the wrong plant. To do this test, you should stop eating or drinking for at least 8 hours before the time you will perform the test. As a first step, you will need to place the leaf or edible plant part of the plant on your lips for 3 minutes. If you experience any sensation which is not normal, like burning, itching, etc., then discard the plant immediately. If that's not the case, you are in the clear to continue with the second part of the test. Place the leaf or edible part of the plant inside your mouth and hold it in place for 15 minutes. During this period, try not to swallow or ingest the plant. Once again, if you feel any abnormal sensations, spit out the food and rinse your mouth with water. If you're in the clear, move to the final stage of the test. Chew the food and swallow it. Wait for 3 hours at least after you swallow the food. If you feel any burning sensation during this time, you have to induce vomiting immediately. Other suggestions. Even if you tested the food and it turns out to be edible, you should avoid abusing it. Eat only small quantities and check for abnormal sensations. Most of the food will go through your system after 24 hours, and only then you will be able to see if you're in the clear. Although some plants can turn to be edible, some people can develop allergic reactions to it. If you notice any rash on your body or swelling of the face or limbs, avoid consuming the food that triggered the allergic reaction. Take pictures with your phone and keep a journal. This action will help you identify the plant better and faster on your second trip, but it will also provide valuable information for others in case things turn wrong. If a rescue party comes and finds you ill, they will know what you ingested and provide proper care. Bring a field guide along. There are many pocket-sized books, but also e-books which can help you identify plants. These useful guides can help you make the right choice and settle your doubts when you're out foraging for food. Foraging for food is a complex skill that requires a lot of practice and experience. No matter how experienced you think you are, there's always a situation where you can be put to the test. Learning to differentiate plants and pick the right ones is much more difficult during a survival situation. The high level of stress, the fatigue, and hunger are all factors that can influence your actions. To be sure you're not putting yourself in danger, follow a simple rule: when in doubt, leave it be. All right. So good article there, and I think foraging is one of those things that people should start to relearn how to do this thing, right? One of the things that I would suggest is, Bob mentioned it here in his article, is you need to get a good field guide. I attended a class with Merriweather, and he has a website, a great website, at foragingtexas.com. And recently he put out a book, and I've talked about it already. It's Idiot's Guide to Foraging. Now, you know, some people, I was reading the review. The reviews are great. I mean, he has great reviews on it. Somebody gave him like a 4-star review, and part of it was because of the name. The Idiot's Guide, or, you know, whatever guide, Dummy's Guide to Foraging, or whatever those are out there, are just people don't like to think that they're, you know, they're a dummy or they're an idiot or whatever. But this book has gotten a lot of great feedback. It's not very expensive. I think it's about, for the paperback, it's about $17 or $18. And it's got a lot of good resources in there. So going out, I think one of the best things that you can do is to get a field guide and get there are some apps where you can take a picture of something, and it quite possibly will return back what it is, you know, what kind of plant that is. It doesn't always work, but it might help you to start the identification process. And so what I would do is go around the area where you're at. So if you have property out in the country, you want to do, and you're planning on getting there eventually, that's where your place is going to be, that's where you're going to live, that's where you're going to bug out, then what I would do is I would suggest going around and trying to identify things that you can forage in that area, right? And so start taking a journal, start taking pictures, and once you find something and once you identify it, go back and remember where it is, mark it, and then take pictures of that one plant at different seasons of the year. So, you know, take one at summer, you know, fall, winter, and then spring. So you'll get pictures and then print them out and put them in a journal that you're writing about, and you can be as specific as you want, but then you get pictures of what it's going to look like at all different times of the year and when you can harvest it and all that kind of stuff. So wherever you live, if you have a retreat area, you homestead, whatever, you have that you can do. If you live in the suburbs or you live in the city, maybe you go to a park, your closest park, and you know, you start to identify some of those things, because, you know, the fact is that, you know, and we talked about this. We had a men's steak dinner, and we talked about I used some of the conflicted cards, and just to kind of talk about some survival situations. But, you know, people brought up the idea of, you know, going fishing and going out hunting and stuff. And that idea is that, you know, if there was a real poop hits the fan scenario, then all that stuff is going to be gone. You're going to have every hunter in, you know, in North America is going to go out to the woods, and they're going to kill everything off. And so, you know, unless you're in the very remotest parts of the woods and forests and stuff like that, you know, you're not going to find animals to eat. But there's going to be edible plants all over the place, and people just don't know that anymore, because it's not a skill that we've learned, because it's so easy to open up your pantry or your refrigerator, go to the grocery store, or run by McDonald's and get something to eat. So invest in you know, some good books, and maybe even take some classes, and, you know, start to look around and start, you know, figuring out what you can forage. I think it's important to know those things that are out there. You might find some really, really, really cool things out there once you start doing this and getting out into getting out there into nature. All right, so that's that. Prepper's Will, prepperswill.com, tips for foraging safely during a survival scenario. Go check that one out. There are links there that you're going to want to check out as well. All right, so this next article comes to us from survivalblog.com. And I was having flashbacks when I was reading this, because I did write an article on a tire that went flat on me when we were taking a trip for our anniversary 1 year. So I was kind of having some flashbacks. But this is this one's called Tires as Part of Basic Vehicle Preparations. And, you know, we talk a lot about preparedness, and we talk about the sexy stuff, you know, the fire, the firearms, first aid. We start talking about all that kind of stuff, not realizing that in life we have some very basic things that we should be thinking about and preparing for that could cause some harm and could cause some problems. And so, being a prepper is not only for when the poop hits the fan, and it's not just when there's natural disasters. Being a prepper is, every single day of your life is like you're going out there and you're prepared and you're thinking on a different level, right? And so this is what this article is referring to. And so hopefully it'll help you as you're out there. So tires is part of basic vehicle preparations. Let's go ahead and read this one. It's easy to overlook an important item such as tires for those planning different bug out scenarios, getting home after an event, or just driving home from work. I was reminded of this during a recent trip moving my daughter to California. We rented a 5x8 U-Haul trailer, hooked it up to my Chevy Avalanche, drove it to her apartment, and loaded it for the move the next day. She had bagged up trash as I was taking it out, I noticed some 8-inch zip ties. I pulled them out of the trash and threw them in the truck. The weather was hot and windy on the way from Arizona to California. The drive was long but uneventful. The next morning, we ate breakfast, dropped the trailer, a long story, and headed home. Driving through the San Jorginho Pass on I-10, I felt a vibration and thought it was the center line reflector. Then I heard flapping getting louder and louder and felt a shimmy in the front. I knew I had a flat tire. We were in the left lane, so I pulled to the left shoulder and turned on the flashers. I got out and saw that the flat was on the right front and knew there was no way I wanted to change a tire on the traffic side of a multi-lane highway on a downhill. I got back in the truck and waited about 5 minutes for a gap in traffic and slowly drove over to the other shoulder. This will be a piece of cake now, I thought. My son was with me and he could help. It would be a good learning moment for him too. We could have called for roadside assistance, but I figured we could get it done before they arrived. I was glad this hadn't happened 100 miles down the road in the middle of the desert. It wasn't too hot. I had a cell phone signal. I had tools. We had water and snacks. We got out to determine how bad it was. I checked the wheel well. The plastic fender liner was chewed up and ripped back on top of the tire. Some of the retaining screws were gone. I'm thinking, and here's my process. I thought, even if I call roadside assistance, they're not going to want me to drive back to Arizona with that. Okay, what can I do? I could cut it out of the way. It was thick plastic, and I wasn't sure I had something to cut it easily. Last year, I had tried to replace an interior door panel and found out they weren't making them anymore. I didn't want to damage it and not be able to find a replacement. I thought, how about taking it off? Okay, no problem. Let's get started. I have my toolbox in the back. About 15 screws later, we realized there were two plastic retention pins we had to access from inside the engine wall. Oh man, I didn't want to try to get those out and hope we didn't break them. I thought, wait, all I have to do is bend the liner back in place and refasten it. But I don't have any spare fasteners to replace the ones that were lost. Wish I had some wire. What can I use? I'm wondering, what do I have in the truck? I was thinking about duct tape or plastic bags, then I thought of the other plastic. Then I remembered I have those zip ties. I could use them. The fender support bracket had ripped off from an attachment point as well. I thought it might have even chewed up the tire, or it may chew up the spare if I don't remove it. I'll just take it off. I was wondering how much can we do while the truck is still on the ground. Then I realized I didn't want the truck rolling off the jack. I said, oh well, we're on a hill. We'd better block a couple of wheels and set the parking brake. I walked down the shoulder and picked a couple of big rocks to use as tire chocks. I told my son, let's do as much as we can and then jack it up. I pulled out the two pneumatic jacks, about 2x4s I had stashed in the side box. Why have two jacks? The one that came with the truck didn't work very well when I first used it. I bought an inexpensive jack and it didn't provide enough clearance. Another one had to use the 2x4s as spacers after the first one tops out. I measured the clearance this time, so a new jack is on my shopping list. While I was jacking up the truck, my son lowered the spare and unhooked it. Do you have a full-size spare and has it been checked recently? Mine was in good shape, but when I had the tire replaced, it turned out the spare was original, which meant it was 16 years old. He finished loosening the bolts and I dug out the gloves that I kept in the toolbox. The tire had shredded and the steel wires would have cut up our hands while we were maneuvering the tires off the bolts. He took off the blown tire, set it aside, unbolted the fender support since the attachment point had torn, and threw it in the truck bed. I folded the fender liner back in place, put the screws in, and zip-tied where we had lost screws. I had to jack the track up a bit more to mount the spare, but we had no other problems. We drove a couple of hundred miles home and replaced the spare tire a week later. What we learned. What can I share from this experience? I think the tire was weakened by the sun. I had just replaced a 5-year-old tire for bad sidewalk crazing. This one still had plenty of tread and was only 4 years old, but had some crazing on the sidewall. The heat and sidewall flexing from the wind and trailer must have weakened the tire to the point of failure. I thought I could get another year out of the tire, but it turned out to not be true under load. If the plan is to bug out or good, get out of Dodge, then be conservative and inspect tires each time the car is used. There may be a nail or screw in a tire. Check air pressure each gas stop. Know how old tires are and have a replacement plan. Typically, manufacturers recommend replacement after 6 years and recommend at least a weekly drive to help the rubber self-heal. Environment or use all affects the lifetime. The manufacturing date is listed at the end of a dot string on the tires and lists work week and year. For example, 2312 at the end means it was manufactured the 23rd week of 2012. Sometimes the information is on the inside of the tire and it's easier for a mechanic to read the date. I will be more conservative on tire condition now. Next, practice changing the tire out, at least jacking the car up. Does the jack work easily? Are there tools in the car? An inexpensive socket set is better than nothing. I bought mine at an auto parts store and it has served me well. It's in plastic case and includes a socket set, pliers, screwdrivers, and also Allen wrenches. I've made minor repairs and changed out the battery several times. Other things to remember. My truck burns oil, so I keep a couple of quarts of oil in my side toolbox. I also have jumper cables, flares, a foldable shovel, crescent wrenches, vice grips, flashlight, duct tape, and a first aid kit. And now I also carry zip ties. It's not a complete set, but it's better than nothing. And I've got to say that I've got something very, very similar to that, including the things that he talked about. The gloves and the tools. My tools, I got them, Home Depot usually has, sales, and you can find these decent little sets. I've just used those on a regular basis. Being on a school campus, I can't even tell you the amount of times it was always, I got a call on the radio, can you go come up to the front? And then it was, something that a parent, his battery had run down, or maybe they were waiting in line and they were listening to their radio, but they didn't have their car on and it drained their battery and I had to give them a jump. I mean, that happened multiple times. So it's such a, I think a great thing to have a small little toolbox or tool bag with all different kinds of things in your, and place that in your car, in your trunk, or underneath a seat or something along those lines. I want to add some wire tire chocks and reflective triangles, a patch or plug kit, and one of those portable air compressors that run off the car battery are worth considering if expecting bad conditions. If the plan is to do some off-road driving, then there are a lot more tools to consider. If using the vehicle to get out of Dodge, it may be worthwhile to consider puncture-resistant, run flat, or even the new puncture-proof tires. I have no experience with these tires, but it makes sense to research them if planning to use a vehicle when the SHTF. I didn't get far when my tire blew, and I would have been a sitting duck if stop sticks had been part of a roadblock. Back in my hometown in the 80s, there was a strike, and they tacked together nails to form a ball and threw them in management's driveway to keep them from getting to work. Tires are a weak link for vehicles and often an overlooked consumable. Learn about them and monitor them to drive more safely. Also check the kids' tires. A couple of weeks after this happened, the same son called me to come help him change his tire that went flat on the way to work. The steel belts were exposed on the flat and on his other rear tire. His spare was low on air but got him to the tire store. I feel bad I didn't check them. Check all the kids' tires. We visited my daughter's last week and I got a call. She had just arrived at work and got out of the car and heard a hissing noise. She had a flat tire. I told her I could take care of it, drove over, changed it. While using the lug wrench, I told her that she was lucky that I was there because the nuts were hard to loosen with her short wrench. She said, no, what I do is put the wrench like this, parallel to the ground, on the left side and step on it. There's another good tip if the lug nuts seem tight. I put on the spare. It was one of those compact donut ones. It seemed a little low on air, but it's hard to tell on those tires. I was hoping it would get me the couple of miles down the road to the tire shop. When I got in the car and started backing out, I heard a flapping kind of thunking noise. I pulled back in the spot and got out to look at the tire. The sidewall was powdery and the rim was bottomed. The spare was flat. I thought how lucky we'd been on that drive to California and all those other times she had been driving far from home. I threw the original flat tire in the back of my truck and drove to the tire shop. It turned out to be a nail that they fixed for free. I put that tire back on the car and took the spare to the shop. It was original and 7 years old, so I decided to replace it. The problem is they don't stock compact spares. It took a week for them to get one. I feel really lucky that nothing happened to my daughter, since I don't know how long she was driving without a spare tire. She never traveled alone, but it would not have been a fun trip to be stuck somewhere with a flat tire and no spare. I was glad to be there to help, since she had a business trip the next day and I could take a bit off the load for her. I also feel bad I didn't have her check the spare after my first flat on her move. The moral of the story is check all the tires periodically on all vehicles and be aware of their shelf life. And it's easier written than done. The other thing that it's a good article there, and I think that this is really important because, there's so many things that could happen that could cause issues here. One of the things that I also have that helped, and I wrote the article on this part of it, was I had Fix-A-Flat. And so I had a nail in my tire, and I was able to put Fix-A-Flat in there, and that pumped it up enough to get me to the place where I can get a new tire. And so I think that's beneficial. I mean, some people will say the new tires, once you put that in a new tire, that it ruins it. It might be so, but I honestly don't know if that's completely true or not. But I know that if I'm going to be stuck somewhere, in our case, it was a part of town that we didn't like the way that it looked, so we wanted to get out of there pretty quickly. So using that Fix-A-Flat was a good choice. And then having those 12-volt air compressors, I have one of those as well. I think it's very beneficial to have one of those. But, check your spare tires. There's some comments here you're going to want to check out. And one of those is that it was a good thing that she did have a spare tire. A lot of these new cars don't have, in order to save weight, don't carry spare tires. But it's great advice. If you have an older vehicle and you haven't checked the spare in a while, go pull it out and take it to the shop and have them pump it up, and sometimes just laying there you might lift bring it down if you're in a truck, or lift up the back wherever you hold the tire, and it might look really good, but you bring it out and you start put a little bit of pressure on it and you might find that it's flat. And so you don't want to be caught without a spare if you really, really need it. So I think this is a great article. I'm hoping that you will go out tomorrow if you are if you're driving, you have vehicles, that you will go out and just do a quick check of your tires and make sure that they're good. Think about the last time you rotated them, and the last time you got them balanced and all that good stuff. Every once in a while when you fill up on gas, you might want to just kind of briefly go through it and see if you see any nails or anything kind of sticking out that you can check. It's easier to drive your car to the tire shop and let them fix it there than to wait for a flat tire, have to change the tire, then drive it over there. That's a pain in the butt. So anyway, hopefully you will go check that out and be prepared, not just when the poop hits the fan, but vehicle preparedness every single day of your life. All right, so I have been talking about the Prepper Bundle, and so as I'm closing out, I do want to bring that up again. They opened it up for this weekend, and so if you're listening to this podcast on Monday, it's going to be over with Monday at midnight. So if you're interested in this, this is a great way to get a lot of preparedness content all in one area in one single download, and it's a decent price. For the price of a regular book, you get 30 different resources. So I'm just going to run through this really quickly, because if you're with me here to the end, you guys are the loyal listeners. I do appreciate you. And so I'm just going to read these really quick. Like, food and water is the Wonder Oven recipes, The Prepper's Guide to Disaster Water Security, Your Shelf-Stable Pantry, The Bohemian Ladies Journal of Wild Edibles, Meal Planning for Long-Term Food Storage, Kitchen Prepper Style, How to Bake Without Baking Powder, Food Storage Made Easy, Canning 101, Your Family Matters, Essays on Family and Emergency Preparedness. That's actually mine. There's a lot of, I wasn't reading all the people that were involved in these articles. I mean, you got Megan Smith, and you got a lot of other people in here. The Guide to Primitive Survival Traps, Prepared Kids, Mini Seed Saving E-Course, that's with Melissa Norris, Patrice Lewis, Low-Tech Solutions to High-Tech Problems, How to Stop Burglars, 50 Ways to Make Survival Tools from Trash and Household Items. Ken Youngquist, I really like his articles, and we read his articles here. He runs survivaltech.com, and really like his stuff. He does some really great stuff. Family Preparations in the City and Suburbia, Aftermath, A Story of Survival. I mean, that's Leanne Edmondson's. I mean, that's a novel. You're getting that for that price. A Prepper's Anthology of the Collapse of Venezuela by Daisy Luther. 6 Steps to Your Quick Win Emergency Kit, Shelley Wells. Homemade First Aid Kit, A Simple 72-Hour Kit. Build Your Own Emergency Off-Grid Power System. Building Cobb-Style Rocket Mass Heater by Paul Wheaton. I mean, that's a video there that you get access to. How to Embrace an Off-Grid Lifestyle by Tammy Traer. Keys to Successful Homesteading, Scott Terry. Living Off the Grid. Organization, Your First Steps to Getting Prepared by Lisa Bedford, the Survival Mom. Prepper Supplies Checklist. Preparedness Planner, Firearm Edition. I mean, you get all that for $29.95. I mean, if you do the electronic download. And then if you want the you want a flash drive, you can get a flash drive as well. That has everything on there for $64.97. And then for $69.97, you can get both. If you want to have the flash drive and the immediate download, you can do that as well. But I think this is a great deal. Again, for like under $30, you get all these resources. And so I'm going to link to that in the show notes. And again, that's only for Monday, and then it's going to be over with. And so, you know, you had the weekend to take advantage of that. So hopefully you will take advantage of that. So, hey, that's it for the Monday podcast. I hope you you get your week started off right. I hope things are good for you. If you get a chance, come by the podcast, episode 154, and drop a comment in the comment section. Or I'd love to connect with you on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Hey, don't forget about our Facebook group and the email list. And with that, choose to live a more self-reliant life. Choose not to be so dependent on the government grid or the grind. Until next time, stay prepped and aware. Peace.